This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
I live in Texas. I was born in Laredo, Texas. You may know it. It's somewhere close to the Gulf of Mexico and the Rio Grande. A great way to start, because I was just thinking, I live in Texas, but I love California because I can say diversity, equity, and inclusion. So congratulations. Stay strong, EDI. Stay strong. So I signed my name in my emails that I use on my phone. And I use student advocate, contemplative educator. Student advocate because I have spent the bulk of my career basically advocating for students who begin their lives like I did so many years ago along the US-Mexico border, Laredo, Texas, on the other side, Nuevo Laredo, Mexico. And growing up in poverty, growing up in a context where I had no mentors, I didn't know anything about college, I didn't know the difference between a community college and a four-year institution or a private institution. There was no one I could turn to in my family because my parents never went to college. They didn't even finish high school. And so sometimes when I get these kinds of invitations to speak at universities such as this, I say, look at you. Look at you. Look at where you are and compared to where you started out. So thank you for that confidence in me. Thank you so much. And so that's me, and that's my sixth birthday. And to my, I'm the one in the middle. And to my right is my sister, Ileana, and to my left is my cousin, Elma. And you can see the house where we used to live. Not a very nice house. And then the one in color is where we lived when I was a teenager, 517 Galveston, Laredo, Texas. So you have to wonder, you know, as students starting out like, and even today starting out like I did so many years ago, how do you get to where you are today? You know, what are the strengths that helped you to be who you are today? And what can we do to help more students who grow up with hopes and dreams, but don't know how to realize them? How do we help them to get to that finish line and to become the future leaders of American society? And so that has been my goal in my career, in helping even the hidden student populations. I'm talking about students who are have some kind of disability, who have been placed in foster care. And I'm about the education of all students, but I also know that we need to pay particular attention to those students who grow up not having the luxuries of being financially well off, of having parents that went to college, of having mentors, and et cetera. You know, so my focus is, you know, how do we help these particular students, and how can we foster a sense of belonging for all of our students, especially those who grow up like I did. And so I think part of that is understanding a little bit more about these students, a little bit more about their experience in college, because not all students are the same. So I begin with understanding the whole issue of how we think about low-income students. There is an entrenched narrative, unfortunately, that has guided education throughout the nation that I believe needs to be transformed and redesigned, reimagined. The entrenched narrative or agreements, as Don Miguel Ruiz in the book, Los Cuatro Acuerdos, the Four Agreements, they're agreements, they're narratives, they're entrenched. And part of that is a deficit-based narrative, that these students and the families have no ambition, that nothing is going on in those low-income communities, that parents don't care, that even if they go to college, they don't have the skills, they're never going to make it, so we shouldn't pay too much attention to them. We need to transform that horrible narrative that has guided us for way too long. And that transformed narrative is that all students have potential. All students have potential. Who are given the right resources, these students can succeed. I've seen that in the work, for example, of Rafael Alvarez at San Diego City College, who is in STEM. You know Rafael? And yes, let's hear it for him. And he begins by telling students, you know, you all have the ability to succeed in STEM, with that strong validating statement that all students can succeed. That families may not fully understand higher ed, but they want the best for their children. They want to understand higher ed a little bit better, and we need to help them to do that. And that initiating college is a challenging experience, so we need to understand that experience and not begin to think that everybody starts at the same starting line, because that's not the case, unfortunately. And that all students have assets that can help them to succeed. And we're going to talk about those. So I wanted to put a little bit of a chart here in terms of understanding the difference between affluent students and low-income Pell eligible students. With affluent students, they have some advantages, one of them having access to financial resources, with the family having a measure of wealth. They typically attend, you know, schools that are well-resourced, that have credentialed faculty that went to top schools. They have top libraries, top laboratories, etc. They can take advantage of legacy college admission, and they take for granted that they're going to go to college. It's not a question of, well, should I go, not go? That might be it, but the family expects them to go to college, okay? On the other hand, low-income students have to work to help the family survive. When I went to college and got my financial aid, I didn't use it all for myself. I always sent some money home. To this day, I send money home. And I'm old now, but to this day, I send money home. They can experience housing and food insecurities. We saw that particularly during the pandemic. They may be the first to consider college. The first year of college is especially difficult. They attend mostly resource-poor schools. And they don't have anyone that they can turn to for information about college, no one in the family that they can turn to. And they're often described with this deficit-based language that I just mentioned, that, you know, they're not college material, they're unprepared, they're culturally deprived, etc. They're not going to get a lot of encouragement to attend college, and they may consider stopping out of college. So at UTSA, I and my colleagues did a study to determine what it was like for Latino students to enter and succeed at the University of Texas, San Antonio. And we came up with some very interesting findings. And one of them is that not all students experience college the same way. So you see here the world of the students, the world of their family, their peers, work, their native country, their spiritual world, et cetera. These are the familiar worlds of these students that they understand. What they're going to do is they're going to relocate to the world of college, a brand new world that is very different from their home realities. And that new world includes experiencing a number of things. One of them is separation anxiety. This whole notion that you're leaving your friends behind, that you know, maybe you were taking care of your brothers and sisters and now you're not there. Maybe you were the man of the house when your father left and now you're not there to help your mother. So it's that kind of separation anxiety that these students talked about. They experience what is known in the literature as microaggressions, these small but very hurtful jabs levied against students. For example, why are you speaking Spanish? What's that food you're eating? Why are you listening to that kind of music? Those Those are microaggressions. And you know, they exist, you know, throughout even graduate school. Look, I got my doctorate at the University of Michigan. And I remember turning in a paper, and the faculty member called me in and said, do you write this well all the time? Well, you can see the subtext of that, right? And I said, yes. So he didn't know that I had an English major and a journalism minor. I think I love to write. Writing, I think, is one of my strengths. Mathematics, no. But writing, yes. So these kinds of microaggressions, you know, continue on. I mean, I had, you know, somebody tell me, you know, Laura, you're pretty smart. I have to admit that when I first saw you, I thought you were kind of dumb. I mean, you get these kind of jabs, okay? And unfortunately, some of that is still going on, okay? And you know what I'm talking about, right? Okay. Liminality. This whole issue of being a part of these two worlds, but you're kind of in the middle. You know, you've got these worlds that you're familiar with. Now this is your first semester. You're stepping into this brand new world of college. So you're kind of feeling, you know, a lo mejor no estoy ni aquí ni allá, neither here nor there. It takes some time for students to process that liminality. And many students come out with, soy de aquí y soy de allá. You know, I am from here and I don't have to choose. You know, they understand that whole intersectional nature of the experience, okay? So affordability is a big issue also for these students, being able to afford college. Advising sometimes not being placed in the right program of study. Another part of reimagining, redesigning, transforming has to do with being aware that these students, regardless of their background, come with strengths. And our research has shown us that they have the strengths that Tara Yoso has identified in the past in her model, community cultural wealth, the strength of the family, social capital, the peers that they hung out with, navigational capital, being able to maneuver themselves in a brand new world, resistant capital, resisting poverty, resisting racism and discrimination, linguistic capital, being able to express themselves, and aspirational capital, having these hopes and their dreams. And then I saw this article by Wallace, and he was doing the same thing, trying to identify the assets of African-American students, and he had all of the ones that I just described, but he also talked about confidence capital, this self-assurance in one's skills, Black social capital, these networks of Black people used to navigate racist spaces, and spirituality and faith capital, using faith to keep going during difficult times. So another part of transforming, redesigning, is the importance, I believe, of humanizing higher education. Humanizing, understanding that we're working with people, people who care, people who have hopes and dreams, people who hurt, people who love. So part of that is understanding that many of us and many of our students have gone through a series of traumatic episodes in their lives. All of us have experienced some kind of trauma, being diagnosed with a disease, being in a car accident, the separation of our parents, et cetera, or a loss of a relationship. Our students go through many of these traumatic experiences, like imposter syndrome, lack of belonging, invalidation, being told you're never going to make it. Some students had never made an A in their lives. And we know that these stressors were exacerbated during the COVID-19 pandemic. So when I talk about trauma, some of it is personal. And I thought about my own trauma in life and growing up as a little girl with my parents separating when I was 4 or 5 years old and trying to process that experience, which is still embedded in my being. So during the pandemic, I turned to poetry to help me to process some things that I had not thought about in a long time. And I wrote this poem called Suspiro, Breath. I've been gasping for a long time now to find that one breath, un suspiro, that makes me whole. A therapist once asked me, when did your breathing stop? In my childhood, a 4-year-old child, head looking down, hands over ears, choking with the inability to process, holding my breath. Seated tensely between mother and father, yelling, accusing, crying, their voices echoing unresolved trauma related to their own childhoods. If only I could speak, if only I could exhale. And years later, I discovered that the gasps have settled in my adult cells in chronic debilitating neck and shoulder pain, trauma now embodied, living in my body. When did your breathing stop? When did your breathing stop? And I ask this question because the breathing, the shallow breathing that we experience during these episodes of trauma, creates something in us later on in life. That settled in my heart. I didn't know how to give or to receive love for a long time. It settled in my body with chronic neck and shoulder problems. It settled in my stomach with gastrointestinal problems. And it settled in my brain with not being able to concentrate sometimes and remember people's names and faces, which was very embarrassing because I had so much ambiguity in my life that I sort of just closed things out and only concentrated on the things that I thought were important. So students' breathing gets a little bit shallow when they come to college. The traumatic impact of invalidation and lack of belonging. It gets shallow when they sense that, you know, am I really wanted here? Do I belong here? Does anyone care about me here? Am I really college material? Does my story have meaning here? Am I seeing myself in what I'm studying? And is what I'm studying something that I can actually use to help my community and the nation and the world and making them better places to live? So we have that sort of traumatic invalidation going on in many of our students. And so in the 90s, when I was a professor at Arizona State University and I interviewed students, I came up with this theory of what I call validation. Basically, validation is, in a nutshell, us taking the initiative to reach out to students, to let them know that indeed they have the ability to succeed, indeed somebody cares about them, indeed they have the ability to really become successful college students. And so there are two forms of validation. One happens in class, and the other one happens mainly out of class. Academic validation is when we take action, not the student, but we begin it as faculty and staff, take action, reaching out, helping students to trust their capacity to learn and to acquire confidence. I always remember when I interviewed a group of students at a community college in Phoenix, and I asked, how come you're still in college when others may have left? And I remember this older woman, and she was very vivacious, and you could tell that she was a leader, and she said, well, yeah, you know, I'm here because of my communications instructor. I said, tell me more. She said, my communications instructor asked us to write a speech and to give the speech in class. And so we were watching me give a speech in class, and I was there with my friends, and we were watching this, and I said to myself, look at you. Look at you. You can do this. And what that instructor had known, knowingly or not, was to set up the classroom so that these students could witness themselves as knowers. Because this student didn't know that she could actually be successful. She told me she thought she needed a 4.0 to get into that community college. And so this is the kind of validation that needs to take place. In the Puente Project, some of you may have participated in the Puente. I love the Puente Project. I'll be with them at Modesto College next week. In the Puente Project, the English instructor, when the students first turn in papers, they don't mark it up all red. They make comments like, oh, this sentence looks really good. Can you modify this section a little bit more? In other words, they do it in a way that is empathetic, that understands that these students are going to need a little bit more help. So they get on their 2 feet and then boom, they're ready to go. And that's what happened to me too. You know, when I acquired the confidence and used my own assets of wanting to move forward, this ganas, this determination of saying, I want to get out of poverty and I'm going to do everything I can to do it, all of those things helped me to move forward. Interpersonal is when we take action to foster students' personal development and social adjustment. I'm talking about things such as sending a note to the student saying, you've done very well. Or asking the student, you know, you want to meet me at the cafeteria or in my office? Let's talk a little bit more about your academic improvement and your studies and how I can be helpful. So all of those things are validating in nature. Some of these statements that students have told me really made the difference for them was when they said, you can do science. Their mentor said, you can do science. And the student said, that's the time that I said, wow, I can do this. You're going to be an excellent writer. You will be an asset to the community. We're grateful to have you join us. Rafael Alvarez says, it makes my day to see you today. You have the potential to succeed. Or tell me a little bit about yourself. Your family must be so proud that you are now in college. So these are the kinds of statements, as simple as we might think that they are, that means so much to low-income first-generation students who are the first in their family to go to college, like I was so many years ago. So when we talk about belonging, during the pandemic, I wrote a preface for the book Resisting Barriers to Belonging, Conceptual Critique and Critical Applications. And basically, one of the things that struck me was that what the authors were doing is reframing belonging so that it's not us inviting students as guests in the institution, but rather beginning with the premise that belonging is a right, not an invitation, but it is a right. You know, if we've been admitted, we have the right to participate in this university. And so that kind of reframing means that we need to affirm the culture of the student, to work with intersecting identities, to invite different voices, and to foster agency and creating counter spaces when belonging is made difficult. And that's our responsibility as educators, to do that for our students, to help them develop this sense of belonging. The next part of the redesign, the reframing, the transforming, has to do with employing humanizing and culturally affirming pedagogies. There's an entrenched narrative with entrenched agreements that we all kind of follow that I believe needs to be transformed. That narrative that is entrenched is to focus only on intellectual pursuits, that learning is detached and competitive, that we neglect emotion, caring, and empathy in teaching and learning. And it all goes back to Descartes, who professed in the 1600s, I think, therefore I am. I want to underscore that I am not against intellectual development. In fact, I am very much for it. I want our students to be super smart, to master the content, to master critical thinking and problem solving, everything that they need to master to be super smart. But I also want them to be good human beings. Okay? I mean, the development of the mind is not enough for me. We need to look at holistic student development. I'm looking at academic, social, emotional, and inner life skill development. Instead of detachment, we're looking at incorporating, validating, relationship-rich learning experiences. I think, therefore, I am, as contrasted with Audre Lorde's. I feel, therefore, I can be free. So, as I think about the kind of teaching and learning that I hope we can embrace as we start moving forward, and we have a lot of challenges right now, so many, and you know what I'm talking about, but we don't have the answers. We have some answers here, but we don't have the complete way. I mean, in fact, we're baffled with a lot of stuff that's going on right now. Politics is one part of it, but then there are things such as viruses, outbreaks. We've got another one on the way sometime in the future, I hate to say. We haven't solved the issue of racism and discrimination and religious intolerance. We haven't solved the issue of gun violence or terrorism. We've got wars going on. We have climate change. We have threats to democracy. And we have poverty. And those are just some examples. But Baldwin and Marti reminds us that social traumas are rooted in the past. Look, when we had a civil war, we had a divided America. This is not new. 100 years ago, we had the flu pandemic. So pandemics are not new. The past is the present. What was is present in what is. What was is present in what is. So to me, when I look at all of the politics and all of the things that are impacting our nation in the world, it occurs to me that we need a new gold standard of teaching and learning, one that incorporates a new set of outcomes that goes beyond intellectual development. The outcome of critical consciousness, pluriversality, which is the ability to function beyond either-or thinking, to embrace both and perspectives, the ability to build community, the ability to be empathetic, to be able to appreciate and work with diversity, and to have a sense of meaning and purpose. And you can add to that list. Those are just some examples of what this new model of teaching and learning should focus on. So I turn to my colleague who passed away. Some of you may know the work of Gloria Nazaldúa. Gloria's from Texas, from a very small ranchito, rural community called Hargill, Texas. You have to drive off the freeway for about a mile to get to Hargill. And her family was very poor. They raised pigs and chickens, and you would never think that this iconic figure, whose work now is known in Europe and South America and other places, would come from a place like Hargill, Texas, okay? But she did. And she's known for her theory of conocimiento. Conocimiento is basically a high level of enlightenment, walking in the world armed with both knowledge and wisdom. Knowledge and wisdom. And so she says, in order to get to conocimiento, you begin with stage one, el arrebato, this loss of foundation. And all of us have had arrebatos, where we're shaken up. Maybe we've been diagnosed with something that scares us. Maybe we had a car accident. Maybe we've been told we're no good. Whatever it is, it's un arrebato. And the second stage is being in this liminal stage where you're kind of like trying to figure things out. I'm here and there, and I'm not sure how to process all of that. I don't have time to go through the entire model, but I would invite you, and in my second edition of Senti Pensante, I actually talk about the relationship between sentimentante and conocimiento. So basically, going through those stages, you end up in stage 7, which is the state of transformation. You've grown to, and you continue to grow. And by the way, these stages can go back and forth. It's not entirely linear, only to be hit by even more arrebatos in the future. In other words, we learn through those arrebatos. We learn through our challenges if we take the time to process the teachings from those challenges. So there's Gloria's picture. And she was big on creative arts, that in order to reach conocimiento, yeah, you had to do the knowledge and, you know, the intellectual development part. But she said, you know, you got to build in art, maybe some dancing, healing, teaching, meditation, spiritual activism. She was very tuned in to indigenous ways of knowing. And so I took that knowledge and incorporated it in my book, Sentipensante Pedagogy. And I use it as one tool that can perhaps help us to reach this new gold standard that I'm talking about. It's a sensing thinking pedagogy, the simultaneous engagement of sensing and thinking processes in the classroom environment. It's going to attend to holistic student development. It's going to include a reflective component designed to activate deep learning. And it's going to employ what I now call prácticas de conocimiento, contemplative tools to facilitate learning, the poetry, the art, the music, etc. So I'm going to give you a couple of examples that I feature in my book. And the first one is my friend and colleague, Doctora Norma Cantú. She has taught English at different places. She's now at Trinity University. And she uses photographs, and she has students write from personal experience. In other words, she asks students to select a photo from their childhood and to write about that photo. She understood that she had students who had been told that they could not write, that they were not good writers, and they had kind of internalized that. And what Dr. Cantú said is, my job to shake that up and to help them believe that, no, you can write. But you've got to start with writing that is close to them, writing that they understand, writing that involves getting into the assignment in a way that incorporates deep learning. And so here's Dr. Cantú talking about that.
I guess the writing, whenever we work with writing, we're really working with spiritual things. And before I even wrote Canicula, I used to have an exercise for my students to remember a photograph of themselves as children and write about it. And I'm teaching description and commas, sentence combining and all this stuff. But I have them do these guided imagery exercises, and they write. And one student was writing it, and it gets very emotional because it's about themselves and their families and all that. But I guide them. You know, we start with things that are more innocuous till we get to something that's more personal. And, you know, they wrote it and went home, and they take it home. They read it in their small groups. They take it home, revise, edit, and then turn it in for me to grade. And this one student came back, and she was, her eyes were puffy, and she said, I cried all night. She says, you have helped me to know my mother. How? I had asked them to write, and she went, and she, the picture she remembered was of her mom and her, she with her kid, her siblings all huddled around her mother. And so she wrote about that picture, and then she started talking to the mother, and so no durmió. She was up working on that paper all night and came back the next morning and told me this and was so grateful. I can't take credit and say I did it. I allowed it to happen. And those are the kinds of moments. I mean, this is just one example of how something worked.
So that's Dr. Cantu. And I now want to talk about another práctica de conocimiento that I love. I use this project a lot. It's the Cajita Project. It's an arts-based contemplative tool. And the person who connected me to that is actually in the audience, mi amigo, el Professor Alberto Pulido from the University of San Diego. Ahí está. And cajitas can be used in different ways. Cajitas are boxes, and so students, you know, can design the box in any way that they choose. But Dr. Pulido uses it around Day of the Dead, right? Día de los Muertos. And he has his students construct these boxes of, you know, people that have gone by, that have passed on, and have made an impact on their lives. And I asked Dr. Pulido to share a cajita with me. He had it in his office when he was at Arizona State. And so here's Dr. Pulido talking about the Cajita Project. Please play.
So this box here was done by a student named Valerie Barra. And the title you can see on the top, I usually ask students to write like a narrative, which the students here today did a great job in. And it's called My Life as a Mestiza, Valerie Barra. And the little that I know about it, the discussions that we had about it, was that she is part, she considers herself part Chicana and part Apache. And so when you look at the imagery in terms of the symbols, you see some of the traditional symbols that you would see in terms of being Mexicana or Chicana and that whole process. But then you see some of the Native American influence. And she did all these kind of different symbols around here. You can see, you know, Christian symbols and Native American symbols. Up on top, which you can't access to, there's an actual field of agricultural field. There's an eagle that's been carved in. There's a horse. There's some Native American symbols as well. And I think it just captures what the students were talking about in terms of those dualities and living in those multiple worlds.
I love the Cajitas Project, and I've used it at Cal State Long Beach, at Iowa State University. This is the University of Texas, San Antonio. These are student affairs professionals. They're getting their master's degree. And they have an assignment to construct a cajita, because basically I wanted the students to think of, yeah, we're going to learn about, you know, the history of higher ed. We're going to learn about administrative stuff. But I also wanted them to concentrate on who are you? What are the talents that you bring to the student affairs profession? What is the impact that you want to have? Who has impacted you in your lives? Students bring in these cajitas. They share them the last day of class that we meet in what I call a silent gallery walk. And then I ask for volunteers for them to share their cajitas. I bring my own cajita as well, because I believe that if I ask them to do that assignment, I should do that assignment as well. Since I published my book, this Cajita Project is now being used in a lot of places throughout the nation, Alberto. And so thank you for sharing that project with me, and it now lives on. So there are a number of examples, and I'm just giving you some examples. My book elaborates on much more than I can talk about tonight. But these are some examples of prácticas de conocimiento, poetry, art, meditative experiences in nature, service learning, etc. And basically, we're talking about deep learning so that students are able to reflect on questions such as, what is the deeper meaning of the project that I'm working on? What did it feel like to conduct this project? What does this project mean for my community, for our nation, for the world? And to what extent has this project created any change in me? Now we're asking the students to really get in and engage their intellectual processes as well as their senses. And I know that STEM is popular here as well as across the nation, and I get asked a lot, well, how do you do this in STEM? And to me, STEM has a lot of mystery and awe and wonder If faculty took the time to really think about how do we get students to think more deeply about issues such as water quality and climate change and you know, droughts and hurricanes and floodings and disease outbreaks, et cetera, and involving them in things such as service learning and mindfulness research and interviews with people and developing photo exhibits and documentaries. I mean, it's going to take some time to think it through, of course, but this can be done in STEM education as well. Sentipensante is a term that originated with indigenous people in Colombia. Orlando Fals Borda is a researcher and sociologist. And he went about studying the fishermen of the Colombian coast. He wanted to learn how they survived. And the fishermen said, "Somos sentipensantes." You know, we've learned through our minds and with our intuition. You know, we know the stars, we know the currents, we know the seas. And so Eduardo Galeano took that and incorporated in this beautiful passage. Why does one write if not to put one's pieces together? From the moment that we enter school or church, education chops us into pieces. It teaches us to divorce soul from body and mind from heart. The fishermen of the Colombian coast must be learned doctors of ethics and morality, for they invented the word sentipensante. Sentipensante. Feeling, thinking, to define language that speaks the truth. So I took this beautiful word, sentipensante, to describe the teaching and learning process of employing sensing and thinking in teaching and learning. A beautiful word. And so I want to end by communicating with you that it's important for us to move forward remembering the teachings of our ancestors. They wanted us to call out injustice, but they also wanted us to heal. They also wanted us to form community. They also wanted us to find a sense of belonging and to recognize that we need to help each other. We are sentipensantes, and we can engage in redesigning higher education so that it works not just for some, but for all students. And I also have to realize that I may not see, and we may not see, everything that we want to see in our lifetimes. But it's important to remember that at least we were a part of initiating the change that we wish to see. So we need to keep going. We need to face up to the injustices and do our part in moving forward, so that all students can have the opportunity to learn, to participate, to belong, and to be the future leaders that we need to bring a just world and a just nation, and to help that to materialize. Thank you so much for inviting me, and good luck with everything that you do. Thank you so much.
Dr. Rendon, thank you so much for your wonderful talk. As I mentioned to you a few times, I'm such a huge fan of your work, and we incorporate your work in our workshops and learning communities with our faculty. So it's just such an honor to be here with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
So I have several questions actually that came from the registrants. And so I'm going to pretty much follow the script, but I have one question for you that is my question, and I want to make sure that I have time to answer it. So I'm going to be a little bit selfish. I'm going to be a little bit selfish since I have the power of the mic. For the first question, in your work, where have you encountered resistance, and what strategies do you use to help people, maybe even students, approach teaching and learning from a place of reimagination?
What comes to mind is that we have to speak and act with our truth. We may not be able to convince everyone with where we want to go or what we think is right, but we have the ability to proceed with our own truth. And so that for me has been very helpful to remember. I don't usually go around thinking, you know, somebody's going to get in my way, although sometimes that can happen. But I reflect more on what's important to me and what is important to these students, because I feel that I feel I've gotten to know the student experience that I've talked about of low-income students in a way that many people don't understand, because I think I can speak authentically to that, having had that experience. So what I'm putting out in the world is my truth, but also it's factual, based on research. Sometimes resistance comes in a way of just a feeling that people have, and it's not backed up by any research or you know, like, for example, a question on validation is always, well, isn't that coddling students? You know, isn't that, you know, pampering them? And when you see students that have been validated, they are strong students. They're phenomenal students because they have gotten on their 2 feet. They've begun to believe in themselves. Why wouldn't you want to do that? You know? So I feel that what I'm saying has, you know, I can back up everything that I said with good research, but also with my own lived experience. So I follow my truth. I follow the authenticity of the lived experience of the students that I care so much about.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. As sort of a follow-up to that, we work with some wonderful faculty here who really do care about students. And when we invite them into this conversation about reimagining education, there's often this sense of like, yes, I realize it doesn't have to be this way, and we do have some agency in terms of changing how things are. And I'm curious from your perspective, and you even mentioned this in your book, that this isn't Senti Pensante pedagogy isn't for everyone, and that sometimes it comes with some risks. And you know, whether those risks are about your skills in teaching and maybe being uncomfortable with the emotions that it might elicit, or other risks. And so I'm curious what we should be thinking about in terms of how we support faculty who really do want to implement the kinds of practices that you're talking about into their pedagogy. What can we do as an institution? What should we be thinking about?
Well, I feel faculty development, which you're doing, is very, very important, but also opening it up for discussions in terms of the challenges that faculty face. And one of the reasons that I included putting that caveat in there, that it's not for everyone, it's not because I wanted to exclude people, but there are just some people that will never buy into this. Mm-hmm. And I totally understand that. And actually, I would not want you to do it if you're not going to do it right, because you're actually now working with some emotional things that can come up in class. Mm-hmm. And not every professor wants to deal with that. So it has to be done sensitively and carefully. But Senti Pensante is a pedagogy that perhaps not everyone will accept, but not everybody accepts lecture. Not everybody accepts service learning. I mean, it's not... Every pedagogy out there has its pros and cons. And so we need to think about it as a pedagogy that is going to need some additional development, so to speak, so that faculty can get comfortable and maybe sharing the experiences that faculty have had in attempting to do that. and learning from each other. Mm-hmm. But I believe that, that faculty development is key to helping faculty to work with a sensing and thinking paradigm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the next question, considering the transformative power of education, what structural or policy changes do you believe are necessary to ensure that all students, regardless of background, have access to meaningful and empowering educational experiences?
Well, I talked about some of those today. I think we need new narratives to guide us, a new narrative about belonging, a new narrative about teaching and learning, a new narrative about how we think about students. They're not all the same. They don't have the same experience. And so we need to make some changes there. We need development for mentors and for counselors, for faculty as well. Unfortunately or fortunately, I mean, we have a lot of complexities. I mean, this is the most complex time in my life. Mm-hmm. We need to figure out what we need to have to help us to deal with these kinds of complexities. And I feel that the old paradigm that still exists is not enough. It has some good things to it. I'm not trashing it. But I also think we need to do more than that. And so in my book, I talk about some of the agreements, some of the narratives that are in place that need to be transformed. Mm-hmm. And so part of that faculty and staff development that we need to have is to identify what are the narratives that are guiding, for example, UC San Diego. And they're not necessarily written on the walls, but they're so strong they don't need to be written. We just follow them blindly. And so what are those narratives that are harmful to students, that are harmful even to faculty and staff, that we need to change? So there, when we begin to examine that, we can uncover some of those structural changes that need to take place.
Yeah. I'm just reflecting, again, going off script and not to the next question. Just reflecting about one of the things that you write about in an article that you published, I think it was in Spirituality and Education, mm-hmm. and you talk about the agreement of workaholism. Mm-hmm. And I was just so touched by what you shared just about your own journey and like feeling the pain in your body. And I think about, you know, what that agreement just in higher education in general and amongst faculty at an R1 institution where there's so much pressure, and our students too, mm-hmm. where there's so much pressure to be successful. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's, I don't know if you want to add to that.
That's important to talk about that because as I talk about in my book, I am one of these people that was just driven to succeed. You know, I just, one grant wasn't enough, you know, and just, you know, had to have all these articles, had all these books and all these things. And I made full professor and I had grants and everything that faculty members need to have to succeed. But in the process, I had gastrointestinal problems. I had horrible neck and shoulder problems. I mean, horrible. I mean, extremely painful. Because of all the tension and anxiety that I carried within me. There's a really good book called The Body Keeps Score. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the body knows. And it wasn't until I sort of retired from the university that my neck and shoulders got a little bit better. So I'm doing better today, for sure. So I feel that we need a new model too of working of our work, that we take time for rest and replenishment, that we take time to be with our loved ones. Look, I used to have a therapist, and her husband was a cardiologist, and she told me, you know, when his patients are dying, they don't say, you know, okay, what's the next job I'm going to have. You know, they talk about, I wish I had spent more time with my children. I wish I had spent more time, you know, with my spouse or my mother. They talk about the things that are really important in life, you know, and the job is important, but so are other things that make us whole, that make us decent human beings. And so I feel that we need to make some structural changes there so that we don't see somebody who is taking time to rest or to meditate as crazy, but that person is taking care of himself and herself in order to be successful, you know, because if we're calm, if we're rested, we can think much better. Mm-hmm. And we can do our work more efficiently, I believe.
Absolutely. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So this question touches on something that you mentioned just about these times just being incredibly challenging. Mm-hmm. So with the current public and political backlash against EDI efforts, how do you explain the importance of these efforts to those with preconceived notions? And what examples can you share of resistance to this backlash? And one of the things that I'm thinking about related to resistance, because I think many of us may feel sometimes a sense of helplessness. What do we mm-hmm. do when all of these things are coming at us? And yeah. so when I think of resistance, it's a continuum of little everyday acts of resistance to maybe big things.
Well, all of those actions are important. They're little ways and small ways. So I'm with an organization where we're struggling with these issues because that organization has clients like yourselves. And look, I live in Texas, so EDI was thrown out a year ago, even before the new president was elected. One of the things that I have reflected upon is that I'm old enough to know that in the 70s and 80s, we didn't have an EDI office, okay? We weren't talking about, you know, multicultural centers and things like that. That was just starting to take place. But you know what? The work was still there.
That's right.
The work was still, the past is the present, okay? So the work continues. I mean, we can call it whatever, we don't even have to call it anything. But our commitment and our principles and our values should not be compromised. We need to continue to help the students that need the most help, the most vulnerable amongst us. Mm-hmm. That's what makes us great human beings. That's what brings the humanity, which I think we're losing with this sense of hatred and dismissive ways that we have about people who are told you have 15 minutes to get out of the office mm-hmm. after you've been there 25 years. That's not a good model. Mm-hmm. That's really not. And so we shouldn't look at that as the model to move forward. So I congratulate California and your university for standing strong. And that's part of it, having strong people such as yourself and these high-level administrators and faculty that are saying, no, we value equity, diversity, and inclusion, and we're going to move forward. Mm-hmm. Other universities have caved in already, mm-hmm. okay? But you're standing strong. You're standing strong.
Yeah, I think you make a great point, too, that for universities that haven't caved in, and maybe have made some changes, like in Texas. I know some of the schools in the UT system have been, like you said, continue to do this work. It may not
yes.
be called or couched under EDI work, but people who are still very dedicated and
yes.
keep persisting.
Absolutely.
What advice or support would you have given your younger self, especially during difficult times or when you felt invalidated?
What advice would I have given my younger self? Throw those comments into the trash can.
Great.
and keep on going strong.
But
you've got what it takes, and one day you'll find out you do have what it takes. So, yeah.
Okay. Thank you. How do you achieve the inclusion of undocumented students within a system that works against them in so many ways?
Well, we need to listen to them. We need to, you know, be empathetic about their situation. I'm mentoring two graduate students who are undocumented. And part of the mentoring is it goes beyond, you know, what courses you're going to take and what career path you're going to take. I'll give you an example. About 3 weeks ago, I had a 1 hour mentoring Zoom call. And this is a student who is from Mexico, and I was born in Mexico, but he came to the U.S. with his parents when he was 9 years old. And in September, he wanted to go back to Mexico after 25 years to visit his tía and his family, his tía, his aunt. And people told him, "Are you sure you want to go at this time?" He said, "No, I just feel I have to go." So he went, and he was telling me the story of what happened when he went. And what struck me the most about that conversation was his interaction with his tía, who at the time that he was returning to the U.S., his tía, his aunt, she had no money, she's very much in poverty. And she said to him, "I don't know what to give you, but can I wash your clothes? Te puedo lavar la ropa? Can I wash your clothes?" And so one of the lessons there is that while his aunt didn't have financial means, she had something even more important. She had love. And she gave him that love. And so she was still he was still processing everything that happened. And we just let that whole hour go on his visit to Mexico and the experiences that he had there. So I feel that listening and being empathetic and offering the help. The other student, I was just in Chicago doing a mentoring workshop at Loyola, and I met up with one of my graduate students for dinner, and she came to dinner very distraught. She said, "I've just been fired. Just been fired from my job." So we had dinner, we talked about that experience. I mean, she has a child and a husband, and she had just been fired, part of the firings, because she had a federal grant. So we need to go beyond academics to, you know, some personal things that are very, very important. Mm-hmm. And sometimes just listening is very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you so much. That's mm-hmm. That's so true, that sometimes we need to put aside mm-hmm. everything else and just be there for a person and listen. Mm-hmm. I think we are running out of time, and I want to ask my question. So this relates to the Cajita project, which I absolutely love. Dr. Pulido, gracias. I think it's just such a beautiful assignment, and I know that you've adapted. You've mentioned that you have mm-hmm. adapted it. So my question to you is, as you reflect on yourself as an educator and your journey as an educator, what is one thing you would have in your cajita that represents your journey, and what meaning does it hold for you?
What's one thing I would have in my... Well, I do have a cajita, and I have several things in there. Well, one thing is things that students have given me in the past, you know. Another thing is my grandfather Lauro's glasses. I was named after my grandfather Lauro. And I put those glasses on, and believe it or not, I can see in them. So, hey, you know. And they remind me of like I said, I've used the Cajita project in a number of classes, and they just remind me of the students I had, and many of those students keep their Cajitas in their offices now, so that's how much the Cajita meant to them. So at any rate, I mean, I you know, sometimes it's a little rock, a little heart, a little note, a book. Those are all great, fond memories.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much.
Okay.
I just really appreciate, especially when you talk right now and when you mention the Cajita Project and other things that you do around contemplative practices, just how you have so much expanded that, what that means, at least for me, that, you know, a lot of times when we think of contemplative practices, we think about meditation mm-hmm. specifically, and all of the different ideas that you share to help students really reflect and be mm-hmm. in touch with, what does this mean? What does this mean for me? What does this mean for our world? What does this mean for our community? Is just so powerful. So mm-hmm. thank you for your work. Thank you for your time and the energy that you brought tonight. We just really appreciate you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.